The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member at tntradio.live. You're listening to McBride and Brennan with David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to McBride and Brennan. I'm David McBride, military whistleblower, and I've got my offsider, the intrepid Dr. Robert Brennan, and we are joined today by a fantastic friend of mine, whistleblower Jeff Morris, who took on the big banks and got a Royal Commission with the help of Adele Ferguson, a very brave journalist. And Jeff has stayed in the fight, and he continues to fight for justice. And we have formed a bit of a band as whistleblowers. And apparently, Jeff, you're going to be played by Russell Crowe in an upcoming biopic. Is that right?
Yeah, well, that's the latest thinking. But I don't think Russell knows anything about it yet, but his name has certainly been bandied about.
I like the idea. I like the idea, Jeff. And it's we've had you on before, but I still think it's a great story that you managed to – I marvel at it, that you actually got a Royal Commission off the ground against all the odds. Are you a religious man? Did you pray for it to happen? Because it was – when I first heard about it, I thought there's no way with the Liberal Party going against it, that then they were in government, that you're ever going to get up. But you managed to get up by getting a few sort of members of the Nationals to come across and a few Liberals to come across, and again with the help of Adele Ferguson. So what how did you get across the line?
Well, look, I think it's probably even more surprising given how godless I am, but it actually had more to do with planning than anything else, because as you know, David, I'm a bit of a student of military history, and I decided that to succeed in what, you know, at first glance seemed like an impossible undertaking, and get a Royal Commission into the banks, if I attempted to simply take them on in a conventional way, I would get slaughtered and shut down. And indeed, there's a strong likelihood that they would have done to me what other institutions have been doing to other whistleblowers recently, which is use the legal system to bludgeon them into submission with big ticket litigation, where people with unlimited resources force whistleblowers to run up bills in the millions of dollars. And that's not a figure I've plucked out of the air. We both know a woman called Sharon Kelsey, who blew the whistle on corruption at Logan City Council. And she has spent $3 million on legal fees so far. And, I mean, doesn't that just illustrate how ridiculous the state of whistleblower law is? But I realised, I'd seen in, you know, all my time in financial services, I had seen so many people go to court against institutions with this misguided belief that somehow they would achieve justice. And I've seen so many one-sided battles end in complete destruction for the little guy who goes up against the big institution. Our legal system doesn't work for them. So I was determined from the start to stay away from the legal system, and possibly I was a bit lucky to get away with that. But I realised that if I campaigned in a conventional way, all the banks have armies of government lobbyists and PR people, that the moment they realised I was moving in this direction, they would mobilise their resources and they would shut me down. So I realised it had to be a case of literally lightning war, which the Germans called a blitzkrieg. We had to take them by surprise, and the battle had to be over before they realised what the battle was. So with Adele Ferguson and Senator John Wacker Williams, I came up with a plan that the media expose should be on the Saturday before two sitting weeks for the Australian Senate. It was on the Saturday, a big double-page spread in the Herald. And, of course, Wacker Williams was on the committee that had – the Ways and Means Committee that had – or Senate Estimates, as it's called, had ASIC appearing in front of it on the Monday. So they got a real pounding in the Senate committee, and many of the senators had Adele's article on the desk in front of them as they questioned ASIC, who made a very poor showing. Adele Ferguson, and this was the key element, I'd figured out I needed to work with a journalist and a politician, and each of them played their parts to perfection. Adele Ferguson ran a whirlwind of articles for the following 2 weeks, and John Williams, Wacker Williams, sadly, he's now retired from the Australian Senate, and we could certainly, it's a shame that a man of his wisdom isn't still there. But John stood up at the end of the second sitting week and called for a parliamentary inquiry. And nobody had seen where it was heading in that two-week period, but the senators were so outraged by the egregious misconduct that had been highlighted that we got a unanimous vote in the Senate for the inquiry. And this was before the banks realised that they were under this sort of attack. So we got the vote. And it was too late. The battle was over. We had a parliamentary inquiry underway. And so they couldn't mobilise their resources. Well, they did, and they certainly fought a rearguard action. But the moment we got that parliamentary inquiry, I knew we were on the road to a Royal Commission. And indeed, that inquiry recommended a Royal Commission after 12 months of taking evidence about CBA and ASIC. And came to basically many of the same, which subsequently did. And I think the key one that's often missed is the fact that the regulator of the industry, ASIC, was just absolutely useless, and that's what allowed most of this misconduct in the first place. And it's important to remember that, because ASIC is just adding to its litany of failures to this day and letting other whistleblowers down as well, I might. That's how it happened.
I've never heard that version before, even though we're pretty good friends. And that I love the military history connection, and the lightning war, breaking the enemy's center of gravity. And it's particularly good. But you're right, the ASIC is the key question, and this is what I often think of when we're talking about whistleblowing. It. It's misguided, or possibly misdirection, that whistleblowers need protection. What whistleblowers need is accountability. And the annoying thing with my case and Richard Boyle's case, I mean, we're fighting tooth and nail to stay out of jail, but it shouldn't be that one-sided. There should also be some sort of accountability for the people in the tax office that Boyle claims did the wrong thing, and also the leadership of the Defence Force that I claim did the wrong thing. But at the moment, the only thing a whistleblower can do is stay out of jail, whereas, of course, I don't mind going to jail, and Boyle will probably say the same thing, as long as there was accountability. And that comes down to the people at the top of the institutions have done the wrong thing. Now, you showed that up, and you went attacked ASIC. And that a lot came from that, to say this watchdog is not doing its job, rather than them focusing on you, as they're doing in my case and Boyle's case, they were able to actually focus on the true villain, which was the fact that there was no watchdog, the safeguard in Australia. And I've seen this mirrored in so many other institutions in Australia, in that the safeguards have been eroded. It's quite a clever thing to do slowly, to put people on the boards or whatever, put people in high places. But this, once the safeguard is not doing their job, it's on for young and old to start breaking the law. But it was I like your military analogy. You seem to have quite a good deep military knowledge. I laughed to myself when I was a former tank officer, and we were commenting on some pictures of Russian tanks or something, and you and actually Detective Peter Fox, another whistleblower, seem to know more about Russian tanks than I did. Yeah, even though I was meant to, kind of be an expert on it, but I. So you do know a fair bit about such things, and I agree the tactics to put it in a military context is quite good. I often try to think of that myself. You know, you're fighting asymmetrical warfare, and some things will work, some things will won't. And it's a bit like I often look back in the sort of six-year duration of the Second World War and think some things a bit like landing troops on Crete and getting roundly defeated, and some things are like the Nazis invading Russia, and even though they're fighting a second enemy, it's helpful for you and sort of getting allies together. I think that's one of the big things that has helped us is whistleblowers like yourself, Troy Stoltz, Sharon, that you've already mentioned, working together, because as you've said at the beginning, the way an institution can usually beat the individual is to say, oh, he was a disgruntled employee, or she had mental health issues or whatever, and they can make up exceptions. But if all whistleblowers are acting together, it increasingly looks like the government, it's harder for the government to say, oh, it was just a bad apple or it was just a one-off. Because increasingly these institutions are actually, there's a lot of, quite frankly, bad people who really do not care about the law and see the law as just something that they can get around. And that whole, but what sickens me, as you said, I mean, you managed to avoid it. You managed to avoid the Maginot line or the Siegfried line by going around it. But the idea that they would, these big banks, in fact, I used to work for a firm whose major client was one of the big banks. And they, huge teams that would have absolutely, and they wouldn't have felt bad. They wouldn't have even felt twice about crushing someone who was actually standing up for their rights. And that's, I think that's one of the problems with Australia. We have lost that. We've kind of lost our sort of collective moral compass. Not everybody, of course, but the fact that people in a lot of corporations, a lot of jobs, people in the government, hundreds of people are out there who don't think twice about doing what I would have thought 20 or 40 years ago was considered quite questionable conduct.
Gentlemen, so my apologies. We'll have to go to an ad break. This is TNT.
State of the Nation on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Parents' Bill of Rights wins zero votes from Dems who attack it as fascism, extreme attack on schools. Our House Speaker McCarthy rips extreme minority party after no Dems support Parents' Bill of Rights. Now listen. Parents have rights, their children, parental autonomy. This is just another example. We pay taxes. We do not want to co-parent with the education system. We are in control. Parents are angry. Parents are unhappy. I just gave a workshop two nights ago. The room was overflowing. The parents want answers. The parents want help. They want to do this alone. They don't want the interference. They want their kids reading, writing, and arithmetic. And we know the Dems always go straight to, okay, you're a racist, or, you know, you're a fascist, you're a white supremacist. That's what they do. It's ridiculous. And I am so happy to see parents and caregivers stepping up, reclaiming their children, demanding answers, and they have every right to know what the curriculum is, the books being used. It's a no-brainer. So I say good for all the parents, good for everybody starting to make some noise and demanding answers.
State of the Nation on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
A man's home is his castle, but his men's shed, that's his kingdom. There are now more than 1,000 men's sheds across Australia, and they're more than just a shed. You can make things, grow things, find a mate, be a mate, shoulder to shoulder. The Australian Men's Shed Association can help to find a shed near you. Yeah, there's something for you at the men's shed.
What's your name?
I'll let you in on a little secret.
Oh, come on, guys. You must tell us.
This is Today's News Talk and the voice of freedom. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to McBride and Brennan. I'm Major David McBride, military whistleblower, and I have my offsider, Dr. Robert Brennan.
I am here indeed.
Doctor. And maybe you want to ask our guest, Jeff Morris, something, Robert.
Sure. And, you know, just to recap, because this is essentially part two with Jeff, Jeff came out of the closet, so to speak, as a whistleblower, internally complaining about the misconduct within the banking and finance sector. That was back in 2008. Of course, he didn't get anywhere by making internal complaints. They weren't interested. Then you go public in 2013. There's the Adele Ferguson article also in 2013. It triggers a Royal Commission. That is the Royal Commission into the misconduct in the banking, superannuation and finance service industry. So when you've heard all the rhetoric since around what your finance advisor and mortgage broker can and can't tell you and all of those reforms, well, Jeff was ground zero. But here's the thing. I mean, this Royal Commission was released in 2019. You came out in 2008. That's an 11-year gap of justice delayed being justice denied. It's remarkable.
Absolutely, Robert. Let me just say one other thing there is in 2008, I went to ASIC. I went to, you know, the people who are meant to be the watchdog, and I did that anonymously with two other fellows, and we spent 17 months trying to get ASIC to do something. And we wrote to them and we said, you really need to act right at the start. You need to act urgently because files are being sanitized. Client files are being sanitized as we speak. We know what we're talking about because they're doing it right next to where we're sitting. And yet that still wasn't enough to get those absolute clowns masquerading as a corporate cop moving.
Yes. And just to, sorry to interrupt, but, you know, there were observations that came out of that were, I thought were remarkable out of the Royal Commission, including, quote, entities and individuals acted in ways they did because they could.
Yes.
It's sort of like a commentary on the human condition. We sin because we have the opportunity to.
Well, that's right. And ASIC created the preconditions for that. The entire industry knew, and I'd known for decades earlier that ASIC was a joke. Nobody in the industry was afraid of ASIC. That's the problem. So the corporate boards or the bank boards, it came out in the Royal Commission very clearly in the questioning there that the corporate boards were just not doing the job. They were not looking out for shareholders. They were not standing up for governance and propriety in a way that they, in previous generations, they had, which allowed the bank's management to get more and more careless and careless and reckless in terms of what they were doing. And in the case of the banks, of course, it was all driven by the remuneration schemes that had been put in place. So everybody up to and including the CEO was on a performance bonus. And to dumb this down to the point where everybody could understand it, it was all metricated with these terrible things called KPIs. So it was kind of like running a business by numbers where everybody had to get so many of this and so many of that every week or month or whatever, hit their target to get their bonus. And from the CEO right down to, the bank tellers, people were just focused on these targets and on the rewards that would flow from them. Or indeed at the lower level, it was even worse than that. To be fair to the low-level people in the organisations, they were more frequently being bullied and threatened with losing their job, like on a regular basis, if they didn't meet their sales targets. So what went out the window was, you're quite right, any sense of morality. And it was replaced with this curious sycophancy that said that whatever the company tells me to do or the guy above me in the company tells me to do must be right. What I have to do to earn my bonus It's what I have to do to keep my nose clean and be a good company man. And I'd certainly seen bad trends in the industry, but I had never seen anything like what I saw at CBA. And it was a truly frightening glimpse into this unreal environment. And of course, that what was being spat out the other end of this sausage factory were the customers, the mums and dads, the ordinary people who'd grown up thinking that they could trust banks, and they were being taken advantage of. They were being harvested and fleeced. And when things went wrong, as they did, the GFC exposed that. The old Warren Buffett saying, when the tide goes out, you get to see who's been swimming naked. And that's when a lot of these schemes collapsed and unfolded, and all built on the idea of charging high fees. And a lot of ordinary people were being hurt. And that was what forced me to do what I did, because the banks then swung into action and they were shamelessly lying to these people and telling them they had no claim for compensation, nothing had been done wrong. ASIC basically didn't, and they still don't, respond to correspondence from individuals, or if you're lucky, you get a standard letter which just says, we're unable to help you, go and see a lawyer. They weren't doing their job. There was nobody standing up for these ordinary people, and if somebody didn't, they would have got nowhere. But it's interesting, and David and I have talked about this many times since, is I realised that really all I was doing was attacking one aspect of a general problem in our society these days. And other whistleblowers like David and Richard Boyle and Sharon Kelsey and Troy Stoltz, there's a common theme. There's a lot of institutions that have completely lost their moral compass. And this extends from the federal government, and indeed both sides of politics, down to clubs New South Wales, where they're happy to see problem gamblers being driven to suicide. In some cases, but they're happy to see the harm caused by problem gambling if it keeps up the cash registers, keeps up the flow of money into the coffers of the clubs. And there's various estimates of problem gambling, but it's around 50% of the money coming from poker machines is from problem gamblers. And these are people who are in a lot of trouble. Now, where's the morality in that? Where is the morality in the tax office using garnishee orders to pulverise taxpayers and frighten them, to just use those garnishees without let or hindrance? And indeed, where is the morality in a defence department covering up, the hierarchy of a defence department covering up war crimes? So, but then you go to the federal government and you say, well, all this is wrong. And they say, yes, we're going to reform. Well, the current federal government promised to reform whistleblower law. The previous government, the Morrison government, and before that, the Turnbull government, they claimed they had reformed whistleblower law. And what they came up with was worse than useless, and we're seeing that play out in the courts at the moment. The current government came to power with a promise to reform whistleblower protections. It's been in power for 12 months now. It's done nothing. There's a promise that they will do something, but you have to ask yourself, I mean, a bit of a reality check. They're currently prosecuting David and Richard Boyle, Commonwealth whistleblowers. And they're continuing the prosecution against David, even though they've just charged the first soldier with war crimes in Afghanistan. So I guess more than anything else, I'm just seized with this sense of unreality as to what's going on in this country, how there's no consistency, there doesn't seem to be any morality in any of our institutions, public and private, and all of us whistleblowers, and there's quite a few of us, and we formed a bit of a network for mutual support, but we're all just attacking different aspects of the same problem. And it just seems to be a modern condition whereby morality is suspended somehow.
Right. And here I have another quote from the Royal Commission with reference to the Corporations Act. It says, conflicts between duty and interest can seldom be managed. Self-interest will almost always trump duty. So my question, I guess, is that though you were vindicated, that doesn't mean that reforms necessarily came from it. And we've got the economist John Adams speaking today. He's a friend of Martin North, who's in turn a friend of our TNT station. He's talking about having his package that he calls about investigations into ASIC and this bombshell that he's going to release. What do you think that is? What is the current misconduct within ASIC and the baking industry that hasn't been reformed?
Oh, look, take your pick. I dealt with ASIC for a number of years, and I've described trying to get them to act on anything as being like flogging a dead horse. But there are so many things wrong with ASIC and corporate regulation in this country. And once again, given the conduct of the current federal government in terms of, you know, immorally prosecuting whistleblowers for the crime of truth-telling, I have for many years been asking myself, in fact, I've come to the conclusion that if the federal government wanted to do something about ASIC, it would have done so a long time ago. But when you think about it, it suits the government and their friends, the big banks, and they are friends. It suits them all to have a useless corporate regulator and have no effective oversight of the banks or indeed any other institution. It suits them down to the ground. So what they've got is an institution tailor-made for the purpose. Every time ASIC has some minor, and I mean minor, success, they trumpet that from the rooftops all the time, that there's like massive stuff going wrong, people being fleeced, losing money, scams hand over fist. But ASIC has a little tiny success, and they'll put a press release out about it. It's an unreal situation. And with ASIC, there's so many things wrong with ASIC that I couldn't begin to guess what specifically it is. But one of the most frightening thing is the system of secondments, whereby people move from ASIC to private industry and back again. And supposedly this is meant to be a good thing. But in my case, when I contacted ASIC, they referred my complaint to somebody who'd been working at CBA for 14 years prior to that. They decided they rang a friend at CBA, and between them they decided that there was nothing in it. So, I mean, when you see stuff like that, and we found that out years later through various information that was extracted from them under duress and indeed questioning in the Senate. And you realise, well, the organisation's so far out of control, anything could happen. And I was asked years ago when testifying about ASIC, I was asked, how do you fix ASIC? And my response to that was, you can't fix ASIC. Culturally, it is so bankrupt, you have to completely disband it and start again. So your guess is as good as mine as to what the latest shock horror revelations will be. But I can tell you what ASIC's response will be. It will be that, this is surprising and shocking. We can't comment further till we've conducted a full investigation. But we'll be taking steps to ensure that this can never happen again, and we'll try to do better in the future. And that's what they always say.
And to what extent, like, we talk about the culture of KPIs and the Australian Big Four banks as if they're isolated, but and the regulatory authorities within Australia. But back when, you know, when Suncorp had that serious sort of survey of their customers, do you want to trade with a chip in your hand? I looked into Suncorp, and they'd recently sold their banking arm to ANZ. And then I see, okay, offshore HSBC and JP Morgan from the US, the latter from the US, own each about 12 to 18% of all of the Big Four. And then Vanguard seems to have a controlling stake in about 5% of everything. you know, 42% of ANZ shareholders were US and 25% in Australia. So to what extent is the Australian finance sector controlled by non-Australian interests?
I don't think that's so much the problem. They're not. I don't think they're controlled by foreign interest. Vanguard, of course, is a fund manager. So, and indeed, the other institutions you're talking about have funds management operations. So, they're probably investing their funds under management. They're not necessarily acquiring strategic stakes themselves as institutions. So, I don't know that that's a problem. But the interesting thing, when you look at the global context, is the fact that the same thing happened in the US and the UK and indeed other places as happened in Australia with the banks. And I think the same thing also happens in terms of things like war crimes and everything else that's going wrong in the world. But when you look at the CBA and the KPIs and the mistreatment of customers, all you need to do is Google Wells Fargo and you'll see a carbon copy case going on in the States. Same thing in the UK with financial advice. We had a class of financial illiterates masquerading as financial planners in this country, and it was so easy to qualify as a financial planner. It was ridiculous. And then these people are turned loose with sales targets to supposedly advise people on what to do with their life savings with predictable results. Exactly the same thing happened in the UK, and indeed some of the worst financial advice that has ever been given, which is almost criminal in terms of how incompetent and damaging it is, is to advise somebody to take their money out of a secure lifetime pension and punt it on the markets. And planners, really bad financial planners, were doing that in Australia. In the UK, it was even more prevalent. And the advice industry over there had pulled all these poor people out of their guaranteed pensions, put them into investment products that then lost them money. And there was a big fallout and a lot of compensation was paid. So the same thing's happening around the world. And the institutions, I guess they act in the same way. The sales practices at CBA and indeed at National Australia Bank, by the way, that led to these problems came out of the US. It was a process known as Cohen Brown, and it was a very Americanized process. And of course, it was used by the American banks. So there are certainly global connections, no question.
Over to you, David. Or rather, we should probably go to a quick ad break. This is TNT.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
There is a big El Nino coming on. Looks like it's going to be strong. I don't know if it's going to be a super Nino, but it looks like it's certainly going to be the strongest since 2015 and 2016. And of course, that's going to have major implications globally as far as the weather goes. Now, usually when El Ninos show up, the Atlantic hurricane season goes down. But I've never seen sea surface temperatures this warm in front of a El Nino in the Atlantic basin. In fact, the entire ocean is warming up at what I consider a rate that can only be accomplished by the input of geothermal energy from the bottom of the ocean. But this particular year, when I look at the Atlantic hurricane season, I'm saying, well, this is not so easy as normal. And it may wind up that even though there may be less than normal activity in the Caribbean and into the islands, further north for the United States, there still could be real trouble. This is TNT climate and weather watchdog meteorologist Joe Bastardi asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you got.
I will be right by your side.
Women can have it all, including heart attacks. But symptoms like jaw pain, nausea, unusual fatigue, dizziness, and backache are often different and more subtle than for a man. The fact is, heart disease is the number one killer of women. Know the signs. Learn more at getheartchecked.org. From Women's Heart Alliance, in partnership with Women Heart.
If you're talking about it.
Over 6,000 migrants per day on average were apprehended after illegally crossing the border.
We're talking about it. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to McBride and Brennan. I'm Major David McBride, military whistleblower. I'm with Dr. Robert Brennan, my double act, my goose to my maverick.
Yeah, that's it.
My Dr. Watson to my Sherlock Holmes. And we are here with the superhero in a final section, Jeff Morris, who took on the banks and won. And it can also, we're moving on a bit from that now to say there is systemic dishonesty, I guess, in the whole country. And everywhere you look, there's a headline this week about the former federal minister, Stuart Robert, and his sketchy connections with consultancy firms. I know I've got a good friend that works in a consultancy firm, in inverted commas, down in Canberra, and they their job is basically to take taxpayer money, and it's to window dress. You know, you can just tell they have all the buzzwords, capability, synergy, world's best practice, and it's all the stuff which kind of set me off in Defence Force to say we are becoming a nation of bullshitters, a nation of real estate agents where everything, you just make stuff up. Don't worry about whether it's true. Just kind of, just it doesn't matter whether the property doesn't look like in the sales brochures. I saw a good, a YouTuber's actually going around rental properties and comparing what was the photo and what is the reality. Now, that is the sort of same in a small, it was the same thing as in the banks. So people increasingly, a number of people just don't think there's anything wrong with plainly lying, making stuff up, and too bad if small people at the bottom get crushed. This is Jeff. There are so many analogies with Jeff's story. I was the same. It was the soldiers, and even now, if there finally is what I worry about with the latest war crimes trials, and there probably will be some more, that the same as in Jeff's case, it will be a case where the leadership, who really should bear the responsibility, will be able to blame people at the very bottom of the tree and then to say, oh, look, we did our job kind of thing, a bit like the government with the Banking Royal Commission, to say, oh, look, we gave you a Royal Commission and wipe the hands of that, and a few financial planners get punished, but none of the chairmen of the big banks who were clearly need to take responsibility, none of them are in jail. And that is a bit of a problem. And I think that there's this disconnect. There was also what surprised me about it, and when Jeff was talking, is that they don't even think that they're liable. You know, Stuart Robert doesn't even think he's done anything wrong, and I think he genuinely doesn't. Catherine Campbell from this sort of in relation to robo debt. These people are actually, I don't know where they were brought up, but they really don't seem to think there's anything wrong with misleading people and dudding people, especially normal Australians. There seems to be some sort of war against the normal Australian. Too bad if the person is taken in by your con job, and of course you just need to get ahead. I saw that, and the psychology of it all, and again, Robert Brennan has got some good knowledge on this, being having psychiatry, trained psychiatrist, but the way people think, that they think that it's okay, and that's as long as they're going to get a promotion or as long as they're going to get a new car or whatever, that they will dud people. But also it's at a deeper level to think that they will pretend they're doing the right thing. That's what really scared me about the Defence Force. Everybody has ethics training. When you go to Duntroon, you graduate and you have years. By the time you become a general, you could tell a story about leadership which would bring a tear to any listener's eye, you know. And yet these were the very people who were dudding their own soldiers and dudding the Australian public. And that really scared me, to say these are people with sort of PhDs in leadership, PhDs in
ethics, and yet they're the people who are, you know, they're like American Psycho. They're pretending to be something that they're not, and there's quite a lot of them in society. That surprised me. I mean, I was 50 years old before I actually saw that. I could understand that there were people who were cranky, people who were a little bit out there, and maybe that had been abused as a child. But the idea that people in amongst us that look like us, talk like us, you know, carried a Bible or quoted ethics were actually doing the opposite in order to get a new kitchen or to, you know, to get another holiday house. That I found quite surprising. And I guess that's the battle that Jeff and I fight. It's not going to be enough for me to, you know, to see some soldiers go to jail. I want to see some generals have to answer some hard questions. This is one of the ideas which sticks in my throat. It's the whole point. Yes, you can be remunerated very well for being a chairman of the bank and or being the general in the army. But the whole point of that remuneration or status, whatever, is that you take responsibility when things go wrong. And it doesn't matter whether you are directly responsible. The people at the top are the ones that have to fall on their sword. That's the principle of leadership. That's what it's about. Having those broad shoulders. And what irks me is that principle seems to have kind of fallen away. We saw it in the Robodebt Royal Commission, where everybody pretty much said, "Oh, I thought it was someone else's problem to do that, to look at the legalities, or someone else was kind of doing it." No one is able to even, you know, and the people would like it if someone said, "Yeah, look, I can see that was my responsibility and I failed to do it." This is one of the things that strikes me with the submarines, and I'm going to ask you about that, Jeff, in that sure, nuclear-powered submarines are faster, and if you were just in charge of buying the most sort of capable machine, of course you're going to choose them. But the big picture, it comes with a lot of problems. It means we are effectively becoming part of the US Defense Force. It means there's no going back from that, and that means forever we are really going to be part of the US. We're never going to be able to make decisions on our own about what happens with China. Now, that's a big cost. And especially since we don't vote in the US elections and we'll never have control over what they do. And we don't know. I mean, they're already getting more and more polarized, more and more extreme. And we can only imagine what the Donald Trump in 2030 and 2040 and 2050 are going to look like. They're going to be pretty out there, and they are going to control us if we go down that nuclear submarine route. So it's a bit of a con job for capability. But what do you think, Jeff, about the subs and about the overall cost? And is it okay if everybody is just looking down the weeds at their particular job, but there's no adult supervision about where we're really going?
Well, look, I agree with what you've just said, David. I think Robodebt really brought to the fore what's wrong with our society generally, but particularly in the Commonwealth public service, where everybody's prepared to look the other way, keep their nose clean, be a good company man, hang on to their job, and, you know, as you say, they're on the internet, they're looking at the next holiday house they're going to buy, and a totally immoral proposition comes up to destroy, to bully and humiliate and terrorise the most vulnerable people in our society with fabricated social security debts. And, you know, everybody in the public service looks the other way because it's what the government wants. When you have a royal commission and you put those ministers in the stand, then they say that they relied upon the professional advice from their department. I mean, it's a sickening spectacle, isn't it, that gets played out again and again. And I think you're right. I think this whole AUKUS circus is it's a replay of Robodebt and the Second Gulf War all rolled into one. It's not only people just going with the flow and failing to exercise any independent judgment, It's also got elements of us being, once again, the lackey state all the way with LBJ. And it is a concern that we get locked in to an alliance merely by purchasing military hardware. And that's very concerning, because it seems as if there are elements in the US, and by that I mean the military industrial complex, who are clearly as sold on the idea of a war over Taiwan as they were with a war over non-existent weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And of course, when you do the accounts as a bookkeeper of the Iraq war, there are a lot of American corporations associated with some quite influential people who did very well in terms of contracts. First of all, to supply the munitions to destroy everything, and then to get the contracts to rebuild them. So it's kind of an artificial stimulus to the American economy to have these wars. But look, as far as I can see, there has never been any justification for us to get involved in any conflict over Taiwan. Australian defence policy has traditionally always been alternated between the two extremes of continental defence, which is just minding your own business, and quite an attractive concept when you're an island, just defending the island that you live on, and the alternative being forward defence, which what that's translated to in practice is not so much forward defence as getting sucked into every adventure that the Americans choose to go into. And you know, even the insanity of fighting a land war on the Asian mainland in Vietnam. We were all the way with LBJ, and I think the AUKUS deal has the tendency to lock us into that in future. And aside from that, the concerning thing about the AUKUS thing is Anthony Albanese seemed to think it was impressive to say it's going to be $368 billion, but at the end of the day, that's a huge chunk of our defence budget. And I'm not sure that a country of this size can really sustain that sort of commitment. And we don't want to fall into the mistake of making the same mistake as the British have made time and time again, of overspending on certain military hardware and then not being able to afford to operate it. And the latest case of that are the two magnificent aircraft carriers that they've constructed. Only when they're half built do they realise that they can't afford to operate both. So they have this farcical situation where one of those two ships will be basically permanently mothballed on standby, and they'll only operate one. They can't afford the crew or the aircraft. The two, in fact, they can't even afford the destroyers and frigates to escort to. They can barely cobble together an escort group for one of those two carriers. So they massively overspent on one particular aspect of defence equipment, and that's now turned out to be money down the drain. And I think that's one problem with AUKUS. The other problem is the rate that technology is evolving at, and the fact that these submarines are so far out. We're committing to a massive program that's only going to deliver and lead times are always long, but AUKUS is so long that you really have to wonder whether drone technology and the various other detection technologies that are evolving at a very rapid rate could catch up with these submarines before they even enter service.
Yeah, look, I suspect that. And I think the problem you were talking about before about the British, it's a bit like people who are not used to finance, not realising that homes need upkeep, and they stretch their budget to buy a home that they can't afford to upkeep. And it's all about the big purchase item. I believe that's the case with one of the ships that they're always sitting in Sydney Harbour. And we bought them because they were the kind of biggest ships we could possibly buy with our budget. And they had noses for vertical takeoff planes, which we didn't have, and no one thought to say, well, we don't need that. But yeah, it's all about the big purchase. Doesn't matter whether it's practical, and that's one of the problems with politics, democratic politics, when it meets the military, because people are looking for some sort of boost in the polls. It's the same with the war crimes. Of course, they tried to cover it up because all they cared about was the polling in 6 months' time. And if they can make it someone else's problem in 6 years' time, that's what they'll do. So, yeah, clash of defence and democracy is going to be a big problem. And again, we don't have soldiers or generals big enough to say, no, Minister, that doesn't work. Anyway, I think we're always going to have to go. Jeff, you are so erudite and good fun to have on. I can't thank you enough. It's great talking to you and hearing up some more details about
It's been an absolute pleasure. And this is TNT.